Nehmen wir eine kleine Hühnerei. Nun das Wetter.
Kam es denn für...
Oh, ist das lecker.
Küchenfunk.
Herzlich willkommen zur 281. Folge Küchenfunk. Mein Name ist Christian von Küchenjunge.com und bei mir dabei ist heute niemand. Aber ich habe euch etwas Besonderes mitgebracht, einen kleinen Mitschnitt, den es heute als Schmankerl zum Ende dieser Folge gibt. Aber ich werde gar nicht so viel vorher hier rumlabern. Wir haben zwar viel erlebt, jetzt auch nach unserer schönen Gent-Reise. Ich hoffe, ihr konntet den Podcast sehr genießen. Ihr habt die Tiefe in euch aufnehmen können, was wir dort alles erlebt haben, wie vielschichtig das Ganze war. Und hoffe, ihr hattet ja eine akustische Reise, die euch auch sehr viel Spaß gemacht hat, die euch vielleicht auch inspiriert hat, diesen wunderschönen Ort mal zu besuchen. Wie gesagt, gerne noch Feedback einreichen auf küchen-funk.de und gerne mal sagen, wie es euch gefallen hat, was ihr vielleicht noch für Fragen habt, die wir noch nachbesprechen sollten, was wir euch nochmal beantworten sollten. Also gerne einfach hier im Podcast oder auch auf Instagram einfach mal Martin oder mir schreiben. Ansonsten, was hier alles passiert ist in der letzten Zeit, ich war Juror am Streetfood Festival in Köln, da will ich unbedingt mit Martin drüber reden. Ich habe mir ein paar Stichpunkte gemacht, aber das sind alles so Themen, die ich viel lieber mit jemandem diskutieren würde, der mir dann nochmal sagt, hier Christian, das siehst du falsch, das siehst du richtig oder denk doch mal darüber nach. Das macht, glaube ich, dann auch viel mehr Spaß, wenn man einfach nochmal eine andere Komponente mit reinbringt. Deswegen, diese ganzen Themen werde ich euch beim nächsten Mal aufs Brot schmieren. Und ja, des Weiteren, seid gespannt, wird in Kürze ein neues Gadget in meine Küche einziehen. Genau das Richtige für die Winterzeit, da habe ich mich schon mega drauf gefreut. Ihr werdet es bestimmt auf Instagram sehen oder dann hier im Podcast eine Besprechung davon bekommen. Ansonsten, es gibt eine Neuerung wieder. Das habe ich jetzt auch schon mit Martin vor, wenn nicht Monaten besprochen, sagen wir 1,5 Monaten, wie wir das letzte Mal einen regulären Küchenfunk hatten, haben wir nämlich am Ende gedacht so, was ist eigentlich mit Chefkoch-Roulette? Ne? Dadurch, dass sie das ja alles redaktionell so gepimpt haben, dass da keine Granaten mehr kamen, habe ich am Ende der Folge einfach nochmal aufgerufen und da kam nochmal eine richtige Granate. Ich werde sie mir aufheben für das nächste Mal mit Martin, wenn wir das erste Mal wieder Chefkoch Bingo, weiß das noch wer? Ja, also Chefkoch Bingo spielen wir dann auch wieder, was hat mir mega Spaß gemacht, vielleicht machen wir da auch nochmal 1-2 Bingo-Züge von jedem, da waren wirklich echt schöne Sachen dabei. Und ein weiteres Housekeeping-Thema, was wir dringend nochmal besprechen wollten. Ich habe die Frage an Camillo gestellt, warum ist mein Pulled Pork eigentlich so trocken geworden? Und da hat er einen Audiokommentar geschickt, den ich euch jetzt einspielen werde. Viel Spaß!
Hallo, lieber Christian. Ja, erstmal, ich hoffe, du hast dich gut geholt. Von der kleinen Tour in Belgien war sensationell. Ich bin schon gespannt auf den Podcast. Und zum Thema Pulled Pork habe ich auch noch so ein, zwei Anmerkungen und auch Theorien. Also als allererstes, warum wurde das eine fertig und das andere nicht und trocken? Ich habe da persönlich eine Theorie und von der bin ich mittlerweile auch sehr überzeugt. Es ist die Qualität des Schweins. Was zuerst fertig war, war natürlich dieses geile Schwein vom der Schwarzwälder. Für mich hat er die besten, also das beste Schweinefleisch in Deutschland, was man so bekommen kann. Sehr, sehr lecker Zeug. Es gibt auch andere sehr, sehr gute, aber das ist aktuell mein Favorit. Und das andere hast du ja selber schon gesagt, das hast du quasi bei Rewe geschossen. Es kann durchaus sein, oder es wird wahrscheinlich auch so sein, dass das Zeug irgendwo aus so einer kleinen Zuchtanlage mit 10.000 Schweinen stammt. Und deshalb halt nichts wurde. Also das merkt man eindeutig am Fleisch. Zweiter Tipp von mir, probiert mal statt so diesen Standard Coleslaw oder sowas aus, macht doch mal so einen asiatischen Rotkohlsalat. So mit Sojasauce, bisschen Lauchzwiebel und so weiter. Macht das mal statt halt so Coleslaw drauf. Geiler Gegenpart an Geschmack. Finde ich sehr, sehr gut. Und wie du schon sagtest, Kruste ist das Wichtigste. Rauch ist, also ohne Rauch gibt es auch kein Pulled Pork. Und das in Kombi ist halt unglaublich gut. Ne? Also wer behauptet, dass Pulled Pork in einen Dutchofen gemacht werden kann oder im Topf oder im Sous-Vide-Beutel, der kocht auch seine Schnitzel und behauptet, die sind knusprig. Ja?
Ja, vielen Dank, lieber Camillo, für deine Einschätzung. Wir hatten ja auch schon auf der Reise drüber gesprochen. Kann ich gut nachvollziehen, war eine dumme Idee, das billige oder, ja, billige, es war jetzt immer eine frische Theke, aber man weiß ja nie genau, wo es herkommt, das nicht so gute Fleisch zu kaufen. Hat sich auf jeden Fall gerade bei diesem Stück Fleisch und dem Anwendungszweck bewahrheitet, dass man auf jeden Fall nochmal zusätzlich auf gutes Fleisch achten sollte. Und ja, Schwarzwälder, super Tipp vom Camillo. Ich hatte jetzt letztes Wochenende auch nochmal Pulled Pork gemacht und habe 3 Nacken beim der Schwarzwälder geholt und war mega zufrieden mit dem Ergebnis. Also das hat sehr viel besser geklappt. Obwohl ich das Problem hatte, dass beim letzten Mal ja das erste Pulled Pork nach knapp 5 Stunden komplett fertig war, habe ich jetzt nach 8 Stunden knapp erst das Zeug fertig gekriegt. Also es ist wirklich verrückt, woran das manchmal hängt, und Barbecue ist echt, ja, es ist eine Kunst und ich bin mich da erst am reingrooven und Zeit ist alles, ne? Also ich hatte beim ersten Mal um 1 Uhr das Pulled Pork fertig, habe es in Alufolie gewickelt, in eine Kühlbox gepackt und wir konnten es um 6 Uhr abends essen, kein Problem, alles tippitoppi. Ja, und jetzt habe ich es um 10 Uhr angesetzt und wollte um 6 Uhr essen und es ist gerade so fertig geworden, auch ohne Ruhezeit, ist auch nicht optimal. Aber ja, es ist einfach verrückt mit dem langsamen Low and Slow Smoken. Ja, da muss man sich auf jeden Fall reingrooven und genug Zeit einfach mitbringen. Das werde ich auch beim nächsten Mal wieder einfach früher ansetzen. Und wenn es früher fertig ist, kommt es einfach zum Ruhen in die Kiste. Ja, und jetzt habe ich euch natürlich noch ein Special versprochen. Ich habe in der Gent-Reise sehr viele Mitschnitte mit meinem neuen Audio-Mikrofonsystem gemacht, was der Martin ja auch schon so gehypt hat und was auch eigentlich mega Spaß macht, damit Aufnahmen zu machen. Habt ihr ja auch schon gehört, wie gut Martin da seine Interviews mitgeführt hat. Und ich hatte es während unserer Reise einfach den Leuten angeklipst und mitgeschnitten, was die so erzählt haben. Das hat mehr oder weniger gut funktioniert, je nachdem, wie laut die Umgebungen waren oder auch wie viel unterbrochen worden ist, war das halt bei dem einen oder anderen schwierig. Was ich jetzt in der Nachlese oder im Nachhören der einzelnen Segmente festgestellt habe, war, dass der Beitrag aus der Strom-Brauerei wirklich grandios war. Der Farrell spricht ein sehr, sehr gutes Englisch und man hat das sehr, sehr gut verstanden. Das sind sehr interessante Themen abseits des klassischen Brauens, über die er mal gesprochen hat, was ich sehr spannend fand, oder auch Thomas hat es ja auch gesagt, sehr spannend fand. Und er ist auch der Brauer von anscheinend dem Bier, was der meisten Eindruck auf der ganzen Reise gelassen hat. Das war das Coffee IPA. Und ja, um all diese Themen geht es. Ich habe das waren glaube ich 1,5 Stunden, jetzt runtergeschnitten auf knapp eine halbe Stündchen. Ich finde, es ist sehr, sehr interessant geworden. Und das würde ich euch jetzt gerne hier am Ende des Podcasts einspielen. Wenn ihr dazu Fragen habt, wie gesagt, geht gerne auf küchen-funk.de. Je nachdem kann ich auch nochmal Fragen nochmal Farrell nachschicken und wir können die nochmal nachbeantworten, wenn ihr da irgendwas wissen wollt. Aber ich denke, wir haben einen schönen Rundumschlag um die Biere und ich verlinke euch auch nochmal in den Shownotes seinen Shop. Ich hoffe, er versendet nach Deutschland, weil mein Coffee IPA Vorrat neigt sich dem Ende. Ich bin, wie gesagt, mega geflasht von diesem Bier und ja. Ich wünsche euch jetzt sehr viel Spaß mit diesem Mitschnitt und ja, macht's gut und lecker und ich gebe rüber. Bis dann!
My name is Farrell Stiers. I'm the head brewer and founder of Strom. So you've probably been to plenty of breweries and you know how a brew house works. You'll notice that ours is this like very old school, very manual system, like nothing's piped together, anything like that. So what it means is when I'm here on a brew day, I'm like just running around with hoses, connecting everything and then disconnecting and reattaching with all the valves and everything. But we had a happy accident when we built this place. So I bought this brew house from a teeny little brewery in London. that was upgrading to a bigger piece of kit, so I got it off him for really, really cheap. And one of the very cool aspects of it is that it's fully electric. And what we do here is we pay all our electricity. We pay an extra fee to make sure it comes from renewables. So everything that happens in this building is fossil fuel free, essentially. So even the brewing, which is quite exceptional, the vast majority of brewing is done with steam or gas, and the steam is almost always like gas fired. So it's a cool thing we get to do. But a cool thing about, so I've got this like teeny little, like incredibly manual, brew house, and I had designed this very basic like control system for it, essentially a bunch of like different switches wired all together, but I'm not allowed to actually wire something like that up. I'm not certified. I'm just dangerous enough to think I know how to do it. So I had to go to someone to submit the plans to do that, and they came back and they're like, Farrell, the future of brewing is all in like wireless automation and, you know, all these fancy bells and whistles. And I was just like, guys, have you fucking seen my brew house? Like, it's like, they're practically like milk tanks that someone just like took a saw to and turned into a brewery. Like, I don't need the top of the line control system, but whatever. They came back and were like, you know, we just want to, no one's bought this in Belgium yet. We really want to show it off. So we will make it for you for cost. And that cost turned out to be like, not even 100 euros more than my system that I had like sketched out. So now I've got this like very manual, very old school brew house, but then I've got this like top of the line system where I can control the whole brewery. So on this side, I've got the whole brew house side of it. So the hot side of the brewery, so to speak. So I can switch all my tanks on or off or set temperatures or whatever. And then I just click here for the cold side, and that's all my fermenters. And I can, again, control all of those. And we just ran the wiring. It's not connected yet, but shortly I will be able to do this all from home too. Which is awesome, because there's like, when you become a brewer, you realize an immense amount of your time is spent standing around waiting for shit to get hot. You guys must know about that if you're doing barbecue. Like, I guess this is a similar story there. And so if I can like wake up at 5 a.m. and just switch on my kettles and my hot water tank and go back to bed for an hour or two, and then come in and everything's right at the temperature I want it to be. It's a great savings of my day. So you'll notice we only have these like conical tanks, and that's because we don't have what's called a bright tank. These are what you call unitanks, which means I make the hot wort, I put it in this tank and throw in the yeast, and it never leaves this tank until it is completely finished beer. So absolutely everything happens in just the one vessel. I do all the fermentation, the lagering, the dry hopping, fruit additions, carbonation, like 100% happens there. And then, we finish it up. We always fill into cans, and that was the thing I was going to show you. So it's one of the things we really believed in when we first started this, was that we really wanted to do cans specifically.
Every can is a little barrel, huh?
Is a little what?
Every can is a little barrel.
Yeah. we chose them because we think it's one of, especially for the type of brewery that we are, it's one of the most ecological choices you can make. Aluminum, unlike almost any of the other packaging materials out there is truly 100% recyclable. Like, you can melt down a can and you can make a brand new can out of it. It doesn't degrade in any way at all. And it takes very, very little energy to do that process.
Is aluminum not the problem that it needs so much energy?
No, well, so the real problem with aluminum is, yeah. Glass requires like many multiples the amount of energy to recycle. In fact, recycling an aluminum can is less energy intensive than washing out bottles in some cases. It depends. There are ways you can be.
And when you're bringing from A to B.
Exactly. What often gets forgotten is that when you're washing bottles, there's a huge logistics chain behind that.
Trucks you don't need to have on the
exactly
have all in cans or only to use it one time for the trash. So the problem is when you can recycle the trash perfectly, you can do it. You have it's more ecological. That's what we have, the bringing the bottles back to the stores. It's but in Germany it's a religion.
I know. Well, so I grew up in Colorado originally, and back there it was like a known fact, like handed down to man from God, that good beer went into bottles and shit beer went into cans, and that's just how it was. And then this one little enterprising brewery called Oscar Blues put their Dale's Pale Ale into cans, and they were doing it with this teeny little like hand filler, like one at a time, filling them, putting the lid on and putting it over in the seaming machine. I mean, I can't imagine fucking doing that with my life, but they were brave enough to do it. And everyone was just like, you guys are nuts. This is like a fancy, expensive, hoppy beer. You're a little craft brewery, so it costs a lot more. Like, no one is going to buy your fancy beer in a can. But it turns out Colorado, we're a very like outdoorsy state. It's got the Rocky Mountains going right through it. And so everyone's, you know, camping and fishing and hiking and rafting and mountain biking and all that stuff. Yeah, if you want to bring some beers along, like, it sucks bringing all these heavy ass bottles clanking around. They want to break. You still have to pack them back out, and they still weigh a lot and are still clanking around wanting to break. And this Dale's Pale Ale, you know, you got these nice light cans take up half the space of a bottle, just physically too. So you could bring more, and when you're done, you can crush the can down. And whatever, it just took off, and everyone wanted Dale's Pale Ale. And then the other breweries around Denver noticed, like, oh shit, these guys are onto something. So they all started canning, and then all the other states were looking at Colorado, like, what the hell's going on in Colorado with these cans? And now, that was in 2007. And now if you go to the States, all the craft breweries, it's totally the opposite. Now it's a religion that like all good beer goes into cans. The downside there is that they are way, way behind on recycling. And the thing is, cans make no sense if you don't recycle them. If you just throw them in a landfill, because the real cost of a can is like mining the bauxite. It's mining the aluminum. Yeah, exactly. Once you mine aluminum, that was the hard part. That's where the environmental destruction happens. That's your big carbon footprint. That's the tough part. But once you have it out, you have it infinitely. Like, now you have it, you can just keep melting it down and keep remaking it. And it's very low energy. Well, I was living, that's what most people assume, but it's not it. I was living in Bishkek, Kyrgyzstan, running a research agency that I had started there. And I met some enterprising young Belgians who had just moved there to also start a business. And we became really good friends. Whatever, years later, they moved back to Belgium, and they once sent me a job posting, like, oh, haha, what if What if you moved to Belgium and my wife and I had just had our first kid and we were like, you know, living in the middle of nowhere, Central Asia is maybe not for the rest of our lives. Like, and so I applied for this job on a whim, and of course it spiraled out of control, and suddenly we were moving to Belgium without ever having expected it. And then that same guy, because I've been here now 10 years, I think, yeah, 7 years in, that same guy looked me up and was like, Farrell, you're always talking about this craft beer thing that you want to do, this idea you have. Maybe we should chat. And that's it's Carl. And he and I started the brewery together. So this whole place was born from a chance run-in in Bishkek, Kyrgyzstan.
So cool.
Yeah. Let's see.
So he's Flemish, right?
Yeah, yeah. He's born and raised in Ghent. We always make the joke that it's funny that it's the American guy doing all the brewing, and the Belgian guy who's the dirty capitalist who's out there selling it. This is Belgian Stars and Stripes. It's one of our best sellers.
Cheers.
No. Yes, cheers. Santé. What is it in German? Prost or? Prost. Cool.
Blood Orange IPA.
Yeah, actually, I just tapped that one. If you guys want to try that before you leave, that's our newest beer, and it's taken off in a major way. I was gonna show you, if you would have interest, our whole canning line, because I think it's the coolest piece of kit I have in here. So this is the, sorry, I'm doing a bunch of cleaning and it's a fucking mess in here right now. This, yeah, exactly. So this is the whole canning line. It's all on this teeny little cart. And this right here costs more than all of this all added together.
Because you have to get it from the US?
Yeah. And the reason is, like, the US is really the only place on Earth, essentially, that you can get this sort of thing. Because of the huge, like, craft beer revolution that's happened in the US over the last 20 years... they are the only ones who do the really high-end engineering, but at a very small scale. So you can buy the best canning line in the world, well, probably in Germany. They're going to be some of the best manufacturers in the world there, but they're going to be the size of this entire platform, and they're going to be for making, you know, millions of cans, whereas the Americans... I have finally, like, taken that kind of concept and technology and shrunk it down to the size of... So let me show you how this thing works, because it's nifty. So what happens is the table always rotates this direction. So if you've never seen it, this is how cans show up. They're just like that. And you put the empty cans on this ring on the outside. So the spinning table takes it and pushes it in like this. And then this is what's called the star wheel. That's what grabs the can, and it will take it through the three stations of the machine. So the first station is here. This arm will then... This arm will then shrink down. Come down like that, and this is just a CO2 purge. So the big thing with all brewing, in fact, is that packaging is by far the hardest part. Brewing the beer, once you know, if you know what the hell you're doing and you know your equipment, you know, it kind of takes care of itself as long as you hit your marks and you're consistent as a brewer, the brewing just works. Packaging, that's where shit gets crazy.
Make the biggest mistakes?
Yeah, well, the thing is, like, Mother Nature is really working against you. And the biggest enemy of good beer is oxygen. Like, oxygen is the fight we're having the whole time. So that's why we spray in the CO2. CO2 is denser than air, so it tends to make this blanket down in the can of just a very low oxygen CO2 atmosphere. So then the arm comes up, the star wheel spins, takes the can to the next station, and you see these two little guys here? Those are just electrodes. So all it's doing is sending a small current to one side of this, and when the beer reaches that, it connects the current and it says, like, ah, okay, I'm full. And that, so that's where it gets filled with beer. And then comes what I think is the coolest part of the machine. So if you look under here, like, this is all full of lids. There's just hundreds and hundreds of lids. And you have this little arm right here. And what it will do is it drops down, a lid just sits right here, and then this arm lifts up, and as the can moves from that station to the final station here, that arm spins and drops a lid on while it's moving past. And you see these two little holes here?
Yep.
It's also spraying CO2 under that lid as it goes on to the beer, because again, we're just fighting oxygen. So then it comes to the final station right here, and there's a little plunger. If you look, you can see under here, that little puck, it raises the can up. So now it would have a lid sitting on top. It raises it up into this thing, which is called the chuck. Chuck is just this big round silver thing that's tied to that motor. And what I am looking for maniacally all day during canning day, you will see me, like, hunkered down like this, so that when that can gets lifted up into the chuck and it presses the lid on, I want to see foam squeezing out, because that tells me that's CO2 going out, not oxygen going in. If it just puts the cap on and there's nothing coming out, then I know I've just laid a lid over the top of oxygen. And that's where you can get really burned as a brewer. Because today, that beer will taste fine, and tomorrow it'll taste fine, and next week it'll taste fine, but in 2 months, it might all start turning oxidized, kind of getting tasteless, discolored, shitty, and by that time, it's out in the world. It's on the shelves at grocery stores, it's in the bars, it's in the shops, and that's every brewer's worst nightmare. So you don't want to screw things up here, because it will come back to haunt you weeks or months later.
And there's no control on the machine that this, you need to check it by yourself.
Yeah, you have to check it yourself.
Okay, by opening it.
Right. Well, what I'm just doing is just watching constantly.
Maybe but this can also be a machine.
Yep.
To wash.
But afterwards?
Afterwards, then you can test them. The thing is, to do what's called a total packaged oxygen test, the cheapest machine on the market is about 20,000 euros, and then they go up from there. So we.
And what? How they test it?
What it does is it actually punctures the can and does an oxygen sample of the liquid inside, and can tell you how many parts per billion of oxygen are in there.
But the tin is. You destroy it away.
Yeah, then it's just trashed. So you just do some samples, and that's telling you kind of what's happening.
This one, a washing?
Yeah, exactly. So I was going to show you. I'm going to grab an empty lid to show you guys how the lids work. It drops that lid on, and if you look, the edge of the can has this kind of curved lip like that, and then the lid is kind of curved like that. So what happens here is it gets lifted up into that chuck, this motor in the center, and it's just squeezed the lid down on top, and then it spins the can really fast. And then while the can is spinning, these two big steel wheels, one at a time, first this one back here, and then this one up here, come and push into the side of it. And what they're doing is the first wheel pushes in and it does this. So it kind of folds that top lip of the lid around the edge of the can. And then the second steel wheel comes in and it does this. And it just, it's just a pure mechanical seal. There's no... Yep, there's no glue, there's no welding, there's nothing. It's really just aluminum, like wrenched really, really tightly, wrapped around itself.
And that's
when it's, yeah, sealed and stable. And so you can imagine if you've got like a bunch of foam around the edge of that can and then it spins, you get beer spraying everywhere. So
when it's working. Mm-hmm. This part of the machine is whole full of foam and foam coming out.
Well, there's foam spraying and stuff, and that's exactly why then it goes through the sprayer to wash it all off, because if you let it just sit there, it's going to get sticky and moldy, and yeah, it's just gross. No one would want to put their mouth on that can, that's for sure.
These are normal ring bearings with an extra on top.
Yep. And so then it spits your full cans out here. So on a canning day, what you see is I'm just dropping empty cans on this outside ring and then collecting my filled ones from the center. We weigh those to just make sure we want the foam to come out. But if too much foam comes out, then you've got a short filled can and that beer won't be foamy and it won't be good. So we're always like trying to hit that perfect mark.
If you start a batch in cans. How many cans do you need to set up the machine to be able to do the smooth run?
Well, that whole process I just walked you through, it will do that in 6 seconds. So I can do 6 to 7. So I can do around 550 to 600 cans an hour, and it's fully automated. So it just... And it's got good sensors all over it too.
But how many cans you need in the beginning that you cannot use because the filling is not correct?
Depends. It depends on the beer. If we're really struggling, it could be up to like 30 cans or something. If it's a really good batch, generally you can do it with as few as like 4. A big part is that the beer has to be really, really cold because CO2 wants to break out of solution the warmer the liquid is. So, you know, if your cola sits out in the sun, you notice it like swells up. That's just CO2 naturally comes out of solution. And so the biggest thing is like just getting all your lines nice and cold. So those first few beers might be, what I do is I just fill this can here. And then I lift the arm up and I just dump it down the drain. And I'll do that like 2 or 3 times. And that's just gets all my lines really nice and cold. And then I hit go and let the machine take off. Sometimes you get the like miraculous day where the first can is good and it just takes off from there. But that's more the exception than the rule. But yeah, so what that means for us, so we brew 700 liter batches here. These fermenters are all single batch fermenters, and then these are all double batch fermenters. So I brew the same beer 2 days in a row. And what it means is for one of the little guys, that's a 2.5 to 3 hour canning run. And what it means for the big ones is it's more like a 6 hour canning run, which is a hell of a day if you're just... here, shuffling cans. The cans are all about 2 degrees. They're all wet. It can be a long, wet, chilly day. Yeah, exactly. But it's great. I just listen to my podcasts. I go into my Zen zone, and I'm just happy that like everything's working out because, like I said, packaging is the hardest part of brewing, and I'm just happy when it's all working well. Once to twice a week. Sometimes on the big tanks, we'll split a canning day over 2 days. So I'll start in the afternoon and do like 2 or 3 hours. And then the next morning, I'll do 2 to 3 hours to finish up. Because it can be admittedly a lot to be standing there for 6 hours, but whatever.
It's the big difference.
Shit's got to get done.
The climate, like summer winter differences.
Yes and no. I mean, it's certainly for the comfort of the operator here. We refuse on principle to like heat this entire space because it's just such a waste of energy, and it's not a building that's like built for it, and the money it would take to you know, properly insulate and then heat a place like this. There, the list of stuff I would buy before that is very long, I would say. So in that respect, yes, for the beer, generally not. You have to be a little careful with some things. Like the beer, it's amazing how much energy it produces on its own. So when it's fermenting, it could be 8 degrees in this building. And if I've got, say, a quake beer, so one where we don't do temperature control on the tank, we just let it rip and do its thing, it'll get up to 32, 35 even degrees. Like, it is cooking on the inside of the tank. And that's just pure metabolic energy from all the billions of yeast cells in there doing their thing. You do have to be careful, like, at the very end of fermentation, where there's barely any sugar left in the tank and the yeast is really starting to slow down. The alcohol content has increased in the tank, so that's also a stressor on the yeast. You don't want that tank to get too cool, because then the yeast will just hibernate and it won't finish out your beer. And the last thing you want is your beer finishing itself off inside a can 3 months later in someone's garage, because it'll take off. Can I get you guys another round? Oh, that was another thing I was going to show you guys. So, yeah, we work really hard on the design. One thing we knew is, like, if you're gonna ask people to drink fancy beer from cans, we figure you should at least like make it a good aesthetic experience for them. And so my co-founder Carl, like, he drinks beer, but he's not like some beer nut. He, like, the beer scene was not his thing. He's not a craft beer guy or whatever. What he did actually before we started the brewery was he owned a small gallery here in Ghent. And he's also just obsessed with like the Belgian art scene. So he's a collector himself, and he knows all the artists, and he's followed them all for decades. And so we knew when we were starting this up that like in some way we would get kind of the Belgian fine arts scene involved. We didn't know what it would look like. But what we settled on is for any of our permanent beers, so the beers we're going to keep making, you never know how long a beer will stick around, but ones we'll keep brewing. We feature a new artist, a new work from an artist. We always get works that already exist, so we never like commission something for a can. We don't say like, hey, make me a cool label or whatever. We just say like, we loved this painting, or we loved this photograph, or even this series. Like, would you be willing to work with us? And of course, as long as they agree, we put it on the label, and then for every can that we sell, we pay them a small proceed, and that's forever. So if in 10 years I'm still making this beer, then I'm still sending the royalty checks to that artist. And to be clear, like, it's a very small amount. We're a very small brewery. I'm not in any way like making any of these artists' careers, but it's like our little token that we thought we could do to just be supportive of the art world. But what's become really cool about it is like the cross-pollination. So you notice like on all the labels, we devote a big piece of real estate to talking all about the artist. It's not talking about us or the beer or how rad we are or how you should come to the brewery or anything like that. It's just all about the artwork. And so while, you know, 90% of the people who drink this beer will never notice that, some people will stop and they'll read it and suddenly they know a little about, because most of them are probably like me and didn't know these artists beforehand. And so now they've learned, just like they've been exposed to the Belgian art scene in a way that they wouldn't have before. And vice versa, what we've also found, which has been like really amazing and totally unexpected, is kind of the art scene has really embraced us. And so now it's probably once every couple weeks we have a new gallery or museum or someone coming in here to pick up our beer for an opening or an exhibition or a gift shop or whatever. And I mean, I don't know how many like art exhibitions you've been to, but like they're not serving fucking craft beer normally. So the idea that so it's cool because we're getting to show like craft beer to kind of art lovers in a way they never would have been exposed to it, and vice versa, we're showing like art to craft beer lovers in a way they never would have seen it before. And honestly, like, this is the stuff that really, really, it sounds cheesy, but this is what makes this whole project like as much fun as it is. If it were just making beer, I mean, for Christ's sakes, if you just want to make beer, about the dumbest way to do it is 700 liters at a time inside the city limits of Ghent. Like, that's a fool's errand if you just were trying to manufacture, you know? If you just wanted to, like, make beer, you make 30,000 liters at a time and find cheap real estate out in the countryside and put it inside just some big, cheap prefab building. What we want is to be like really tied in with the community here. You see them, like, they're going to be harvesting hops that we planted all around the neighborhood. And all the neighbors will come in and help us trim the hops, and then we'll make a fresh hop beer together, and the whole neighborhood gets to like celebrate, like, oh, it's like our terroir. It's the terroir of our little neighborhood here in this one beer. And like that, and the artist collaboration, that's the shit that like keeps it like really exciting and fun here, instead of it just being some, I don't know, commercial project or some, you know, we're not just manufacturers here. We are manufacturers, but we're also...
You can live from that?
Everybody, yeah. Admittedly, I took a huge pay cut from being in research to doing this, but... I sleep great at night now. Like my last job, it's the old cliche, but I hated it. I fucking hated it. It was like, you know, Sunday nights, the dread, you know, starts to sink in because you're thinking about like, oh Christ, I have to like.
But only what I do is for the money. I hate my job. Work for the money. With the money.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's what I did for years.
It's not a really good deal for my feeling, but for my life, it's okay.
Yeah. And like a lot of people can, and I did make that work for many years. But then I found this, and so far we're making enough to live. And so it's the full-time job of Carl and I, the founders, and we have two part-time employees, and that's the whole team, so to speak. And so far it seems to be working. I mean, it's a struggle. It's definitely a fight. And every month, you know, we're having to look seriously at the numbers, and we're having to think of new projects to keep things exciting and keep them going. But yeah.
And how you do the coffee is really good.
I'll explain. You're all set? Cool.
Thank you.
Thanks, man. The way, well, here, I'll show you. Wow, this is all full of liquid right now, but I've got this little tank. And then I have this that sits down inside the tank. So what I do is I brew the beer, I ferment it out, I dry hop it. It's a completely finished beer in the tank. And then what I do is I bring out my little hand, my little, it's electric, but like teeny little coffee grinder. And I open up my beans and I spray them down with vodka, yeah. Just with a little in a spray bottle, so that it kills anything that might be living on the beans. Yeah. Throw them one at a time into the grinder and just a really rough grind. And then I toss it in this, put that in there. And then I seal it all up, connect it with a hose to the tank, purge everything with CO2 so there's no oxygen anywhere. And then what I do is I flood the tank with beer, like the little tank, and then push it back in with CO2, and I just go back and forth like that for 4 hours or something. And that's what gets it in. Yeah, it's a mind fuck, right? Because it's like this blonde, fresh IPA, but...